Okay, so this is the, I should write C++ object-oriented programming seminar. So I'm just going to kind of introduce you to the ideas, the big ideas behind object-oriented programming. And I'd be happy to ask or answer questions if you have questions. I'm also going to talk briefly about the STL, which is the standard template library, which is basically a set of data structures that are implemented for you in C++. And more so than objects, the reason I will write C++ code rather than C code is because I get the STL for free, which is very, very nice, because like no one wants to implement their own resizable array. So you'd like to be able to just kind of start with an array that's blank and keep putting stuff into the array as much stuff as you want without ever worrying about the fact that underneath the hood for this array, it's actually being stored with a fixed size C-style array. But you'd like to be able to just keep, you know, pushing onto it and have the array resize itself, you know, underneath the hood whenever you need to. Okay, so that's the STL, and then we'll just kind of just practice thinking in terms of objects. For maybe a tic-tac-toe program or something. So, cool. So, what is an object? So, an object is essentially like a struct that we saw in C. So, we would have a struct thing. And the basic idea is that we want to group some data in here, so we may want an int x and a character buffer 128, which is like a string, and maybe we want some other types in here, and this thing would be like an object. So a thing is just kind of a grouping of primitive data types, if that makes sense. And this was nice, and we found structs very useful, you know, towards when we got to, you know, the PUF program and kind of bigger programs, it didn't make sense to always just use primitive data types. We needed to think of, like, fancier data types, like a tree node, for instance. You know, that's kind of the building block for our tree. And so you wouldn't want to have to pass around, you know, some value and to, like, a left and a right pointer. You wouldn't want to pass them around separately. You'd want to just kind of combine them all, since they form one logical entity of a tree node. So that's an object, but C takes objects a little bit further. So in C, objects are defined by classes. So let me give a slightly better example here. So maybe if we had a struct student, we would have an int age, a double GPA, and a name, which will risk a buffer overrun and just make the name a fixed 128 characters. So we could do this same thing, which is a struct in C, in C++. So we'd make a class student, and I'm going to put this public keyword, which will make more sense in a second. But we're just going to declare int age here, double GPA. And I'm just going to convert to C land, where we actually finally, thank goodness, or C++ land, where we actually finally, thank goodness, have a string type. By the way, this is defined in the standard package. So if you want to refer to string, you need to write using namespace standard. And this is a little beyond the scope of this seminar, but just take my word for it that you'll want using namespace standard. The other thing you can do is you can always prefix these things with std colon colon, but that gets really annoying really quickly, so you just want this line at the top of your .c files, well, also .h, I guess, if you refer to strings. All right, so So here we've implemented the same structure using a class, but we haven't really bought ourselves much yet. So, okay, so let's say we made this structure and we wanted to we wanted to pass it to another programmer who was like printing out statistics about the student. Maybe I should show you first how you make one of these. So it does an automatic type def for you. So you can just say student S, and that would make a student. And then kind of like a struct, you could say S dot age equals, 19 or whatever, and set the structs field or the classes fields in that way. But kind of the data here. Yeah, so does it work with pointers? Yeah, sure. So the other main way of making a class is you would say student pointer S equals, and then instead of malloc, which is what we use in C, we just have a new keyword, and the keyword is called new. So you say new student like this. So then you would say S arrow age equals 19.
Class there was equivalent to, class was a word for type def struct. Just like what we've done in C.
Right.
One case where we couldn't just do that in C was if we wanted inside the object.
Oh, I see. So this does the nice natural thing. So if we needed like a student pointer in here, I don't know why you'd have one, but you could have something like this, and it would do the right thing. Right. So that one thing that the class buys us, and this is not the most important thing, in the higher level conceptually stuff, but it does buy us that type def, which is nice. We don't need to retype def the struct to do anything. It just does a type def automatically, and this is kind of what we should expect out of C, and it's kind of unfortunate that it doesn't do that. All right, so we don't actually need a next field, so I'm not going to leave it there, but you could do that if you wanted. Cool, so these are kind of the two different ways of making the actual instance of a student. You can declare it on the stack, which is just kind of like if you declared a struct, struct student S, and you can declare it on the, or you can ask for some heap memory for it, and this is really equivalent to a malloc call. Like new and malloc are pretty much synonymous in every way, but we'll talk a little bit more about why they might be different in a little bit. All right, so this is kind of a class, but we haven't really gotten ourselves anything big picture yet. So we can imagine that a student, I'm just going to take it over here. So kind of a fundamental, here's what I'm trying to say, a fundamental flaw with this struct student that I just erased is all of the data is transparent. So no matter what you do, there is never anything preventing another programmer that is using your student struct or whatever from just changing the age at any point, even worse, maybe changing the name to be foo. Presumably, you'd like to have some control over what kinds of data they're allowed to change and what data they aren't allowed to change. So maybe in the context of students in this little world we have is they can never change name. Once a student has a name, they're stuck with that name, and the idea of name changing isn't allowed. So the way you could make that happen in C++ is you can encapsulate your data. So when we declare class student, we are going to, instead of making everything public like we did over there, we're going to declare these as private variables. And so we can have int age, double GPA, and string name. And then we might have some public variables too. Public variables or methods, so I'll get there in a second. So these are now private data members. So They're accessible within student, and we'll see what that means in a second. But now the outside world, when they make a student S, and they say S.age, the compiler doesn't let them do this. It says, oh, I don't even know what this age field you're talking about is. Even though there is an age field in student, since it's private outside, in this outside world, we can't see the age. So that kind of motivates the question, well, where the heck can we see the age if we can't see it out here? So the other thing that C++ buys us that C doesn't give us is that these objects can have actions associated with them. So so these are kind of like actions that the student would be able to do. So you know, one function we might want to have is like shout. Maybe the student has this shouting ability, and maybe it also has an ability called getAge, which tells the outside world what age the student is, and then maybe if we're going to allow the age to be changed, it would have a function called setAge, which would take a variable new age, and it would set this private variable to hold that new age. So, so the way this would work is we'd make a student S, and then if we wanted to get the age of the student, we could say like int age equals s.getAge, and assuming the age had been set properly, which we're not doing yet, this will return the age of the student, and we could get the age here. And if we want to change the age, we could say int, or we could do s.setAge to 15. And now if we were to get age again, we'd get back the value 15 for age. All right, so kind of what we're getting ourselves now is this control over what features of our interface we want to expose to the outside world. Those things we will make public. And then what features of our interface are private to our own class's functioning. So the reason you typically want to do this is when you're programming, kind of the world that you're programming is just a world of these different objects. And each programmer is supposed to implement certain objects. And we'll talk about this in the last section, thinking in objects, you know, real world examples of what this might mean. But for now, let's just assume that each programmer is doing their own object. So now you can very, you know, specifically define what your public interface is to the world, how the world is allowed to use your object. And that's these public functions, and occasionally you'll have public variables, although that's usually not considered a good idea. And then the private variables, you know, these are kind of like, we'll think of them as like implementation details. Right? They're private to the class. Only the class can, only the actual code of the class can manipulate them. And the outside world can't see them. And just so everyone's clear, like, let's just implement quickly this getAge function. So this would normally go in a .h file, this class declaration, and then in a .cpp file or a .cc file, you would put the actual implementation of this student. And so let's say we wanted to implement getAge. So you'd have return type int. Then we'd say we're implementing this for the student class. So student colon colon means we're implementing the student class's function. And so let's say we're implementing getAge. What do you think getAge is going to look like? Pretty simple. Okay, so very close. So we don't actually need to say student dot. So since we are in student's namespace, we can just say age. Because since we're in student, it knows that we're allowed to look at the student's variables, private variables. So we can just return age. But yeah, student age was not a bad guess. Okay, and similarly, you know, we can write set age, should be pretty trivial. Int new age. What is this one going to look like? Great, so age equals new age. Perfect. And so specifically what this is doing is this age refers to this private class variable, and we're changing that to be, you know, this information that's coming from the outside world. So age is kind of like a naked variable in a sense that the outside world is able to both see it and set it. Whereas name, as I said before, in this little world we have, we're not going to allow students to change their names. So what are we going to expose to the user for a student? And what are we not going to expose? So we don't want the outside world to be able to change name. But presumably we'd like them to be able to check the name of the student.
Maybe in the shout function so you can print out their name.
Okay, so right. So you can make the shout function print out their name. Sure, that's a very reasonable thing to do. If we wanted to allow the person to get the name as a variable, we might just kind of say string get name, kind of similar to get age, and that would be this is called an accessor usually. So we do get name and we implement it kind of like we did over there. And specifically, we would not implement a set name function, because we don't want to allow the outside world to set a name in this example. So this is what this is. This privacy, this abstraction barrier, is what C++ and object-oriented programming are kind of all about in a sense. So when you're designing some giant interface, the programmer is going to show you the .h file. And you'll be able to kind of inspect the public functions and figure out what those public functions do. And you won't even, need to see the private variables or need to see the private functions. You can have private functions too. These are just like internal functions that can't be called by the outside users. So this is like an implementation detail function. It'll make more sense if you're doing your own. You'll see a place where you have a private function that is kind of for a task that's only performed within the class and that the outside user shouldn't be able to perform on your class. And these are all like implementation details that are up to the person implementing the library. So the interface, the outside world stuff, is all of this public stuff. And that's ultimately what the person using your library is going to read and get information from. So is everyone clear on kind of the point of objects? All right, so objects get you these methods. So now you can do stuff with the objects. You don't just have these static objects that are just a collection of data. You have this collection of data that can perform these actions. And they also give you this abstraction barrier. So that this is kind of all, by the way, this is what CS51 is all about, is about building up these abstraction barriers. And now you have this abstraction barrier where you can't even see how student is really implemented because you can't see these private variables from the outside. I mean, obviously, if you have the source code for student.cc, you can see how it's implemented. But they don't even need to provide you with that. They can just compile student.cc into an object file, give you the object file, give you the .h file, and then you really won't know how student.cc is implemented, which is great because you shouldn't need to know. You assume that the person giving you the student class is a reasonably good programmer, hopefully. If you work at a bad company, this might not be true. Which would be unfortunate, but you can just kind of hope that their implementation works and then just use their public interface to do whatever you need to do with it. And of course, if their public interface is designed badly, maybe it doesn't expose all of the functionality that it should. And in that case, it means that it's their fault for not providing you with the right functions to use the student in a useful way. All right. So that's kind of the big idea behind objects. So I'm going to erase this if there are no more questions. Right. Okay. So the other huge idea behind object-oriented programming is inheritance. So let me just draw up kind of the trivial example that I've gone over so many times it makes me sick, but we'll do it again. So let's say we had this class shape, and the way we wanted to define a shape is like a two-dimensional object. Oh, shoot. Sorry, I should have gone over one other thing in my previous discussion. Let me do this before I do that. In the class student, we need ways of making the student have the correct variables, and then ways of destroying the student. If we've allocated resources in the student, like made a call to new, which is like malloc, then we want a way to make a call to delete, which is like free. So we have these things called a constructor and a destructor. And the constructor is simply declared like this and can take varying number of arguments. And the destructor is like a twiddle and it never takes any arguments. And so, you know, you'd have all these other things. And they're always public. The constructor and the destructor should always be public. So let's say when we make a student, we want to require that they specify an int age, a double GPA, and a string name, because those are the three things required for a student, let's say. So now when they declare a student, it will automatically call the constructor. So student S, that automatically calls the default constructor, which doesn't initialize anything. But if we wanted to call a fancy constructor, the way that we do that is we say student S, and then we pass arguments. So like 19 was the age, and the GPA is 4.0, and the name is Thomas. I'm not actually 19, but everything else is accurate. And so now S, so now this constructor is called, and S presumably has these values. But the constructor is something that needs to be implemented. So how would we implement this constructor? So we have to write this function too. So notice the constructor doesn't have a return type. So in your .cc file or .cpp file, we say student colon colon student. And we take int age, double GPA, and string name. Assume we have an int age here, a double GPA, and a string name. So what essentially do we want this constructor to do? So we're getting past these three things from the outside world. And what do you think we want to do with these three things? Should we just ignore them, or what would we like to happen? Store them, exactly. We want to store these things getting passed in these three variables down here. So I've caused a rather nasty problem for us. I've named these class variables the same thing as these input variables. This was just to illustrate another point. Right. So you would, I mean, so if I had named them like int A, double G, and string N, then I could just write like age equals A. So if this was A, if this was G, and if this was N, I could write age equals A, GPA equals G, and name equals N, and that would be enough. So normally you name these things different than these things. But let's say you were not so clever and you did it like I did it. We need a way to refer to the class variable's age. We want to set this age equal to this age. So there's this keyword, this, which is like a pointer to the object that you're in. And this arrow age always refers to the class variable here. And then age will refer to the parameter being passed in. So again, this is kind of two different points I'm bringing up. How to do the constructor, and then also what happens if you have these variable shadowing problems where you've named the thing coming into the function the same thing as the actual name of the class variable. So this arrow age equals age, this arrow GPA equals GPA, and this arrow name equals name. So this is all a constructor ever does most of the time. If you had a constructor for a deck, what might be a deck of cards? What might be another reasonable thing to do in that constructor? So after you've made your deck, you know, presumably pushed 52 ints onto an array or something, what might be another reasonable thing to do after you've made the deck of cards? Right. You might want to shuffle them in the constructor. So that after a deck had been made, the assumption is that it will be a shuffled deck of cards. So then at the end of your constructor, you might call a shuffle function or something after you've set up the array. And that might be another reasonable thing to do. So basically, the constructor is just automatically called when the student is made. And then when the student kind of goes out of scope, or when delete is called on the student, if it was something that was malloced, that's when the destructor is invoked. And you don't need to worry about it too much. But if you did, for whatever reason, like if you had malloced, let's just leave that how it was. So if for whatever reason we had, I'm just trying to think of a good example. Okay. I did not think of a good example. Let's say we had malloced or made a new waste variable. It said waste equals new int, which just mallocs one int on the heap for whatever reason. We're just wasting some space in our class. Sorry, I don't have better motivation. But the point is that this is a dynamically allocated variable. So when the object is destructed, it's our responsibility to delete this this dynamically allocated variable, because this is on the heap. All of this stuff is on the stack, so that's safe. That'll just go away automatically. But this is, like, we malloced it. It's on the heap. So when student is destructed, so let's write the destructor, student colon colon twiddle student, what is this code supposed to do? So it doesn't need to do anything for these three, because they'll just go away automatically. But it does need to do something for waste. Free it, exactly. And the word for free in C++ is delete, but the idea is exactly the same, and you do delete waste. So anything that you've nude, what a good word. Anything that you have done new something, you need to delete it on the other side. So it's kind of like in C, where whenever you malloc something, you need to free it. Whenever you new something in C++, you need to delete it on the other side. So that's what this destructor is for. So that's kind of the last piece that objects have.
Did
that
you say everything else was taken care of?
Right. So this stuff is all on the stack, so it's taken care of. So you're only responsible for matching up kind of deletes with whatever you newed. All right. So back to where we were supposed to, where we were going to shape. So everyone's clear on all this stuff? Okay, so inheritance. So we might have this generic shape, and every shape in order to be useful, a shape needs to be able to get area. So you need to be able to ask a shape for its area. That's the primary, or maybe it should be a double. That's the primary information we need coming out of a shape. Then maybe we'd have a constructor and a destructor, and perhaps it would have other things that we're not really worried about right now. So we have this generic shape. So there are lots of things that kind of, well, maybe let's define some of these. So so in the CPP file, we might have something like double shape colon colon get area. And shape is kind of a silly, shape, we don't really have enough information to get area, so maybe we'll just return -1 or something. And the shape constructor and destructor, we probably don't need them to do anything since they don't really take any arguments. Oops. Shape, colon, colon, shape. So we'll just define them as empty functions. Like so. All right, so now let's make an actual shape. So, class triangle. And we want to say that triangle should inherit all of the stuff that shape gives us already. So, trying to think of a good way of motivating this. Well, I, again, don't have a good way of motivating. So let's say one thing we had implemented for shape was other shapey thing, which does a function that all shapes should be able to do. I don't know what that function is, but all other shapey thing. So we'd like triangle perimeter. Sure. Well, I want something generic that everyone can share. So the problem with perimeter is each shape is going to need to define its own perimeter, kind of like get area. But let's just say shapes need to be able to dance or something on the screen. So all shapes need to share this function. I should have come up with a better example. There are better examples in the world, I promise you. Rotate. Well, okay, sure. Let's assume that there's like some good way of rotating that works on all shapes. Good. So all shapes should just be able to get this rotate function for free. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to say class triangle, and then we're going to say public, so single colon, and it's a form public shape. So the triangle inherits shape's properties. So if we just do this, so now the triangle constructor should probably take some arguments. Let's assume it's a, you know what, let's just make it a square so we need to, oh no, it's okay. We'll assume it's a triangle. And here we need an int base and int height. That's what a triangle is supposed to have. And the destructor is probably not going to do anything, but we'll put it down. By the way, you don't need to actually declare a destructor if it's not doing anything. It'll just provide a default destructor. Anyway, so now, just automatically, it just gets, you don't need to write it here, but it gets, in our minds, it gets the rotate function, and it gets the get area function for free. And the way it gets it for free is because we said, well, a triangle is just the kind of shape. So it gets all of the things that shape can do, which is rotate and get area. So now we could literally say, and you don't write this in the C file, the stuff that's in brackets, this is just in our minds so that we remember that it has these functions. So now you can say triangle T, and just a quick review, how do we finish declaring that triangle? So that it calls our correct constructor. What? New? Good. Triangle star T equals new. And we make a new triangle like so. And I don't know if I actually showed you this with new, but we put in parentheses 5, 10. And you would put a semicolon, and that gives us a new triangle. This is a triangle that's allocated how? On the heap, right, instead of on the stack. If we had wanted to do one on the stack, what would we have done? Either one is totally fine. So I kind of did it up here quickly, so you might not have seen it. Triangle T, and then you just put in parentheses the arguments right after it. So this will tell it to call that constructor. All right, and now we could say T dot rotate, and it would do whatever Adam's magical rotate function was. And we could say T dot get area, and it will return a very satisfying what? -1, right, because it will call shapes get area. Oops, that doesn't seem quite right. I mean, now we have a real triangle with a base and a height. We should be able to compute the area. I mean, we could look it up on Wikipedia, but we should remember eventually that the how do we get the base and, or the area from the base and the height? Oh man, he's good. 1/2 base times height. Good. So we'd like to be able to kind of like override the this get area function in shape, which is just returning a trivial -1, with like a real get area function, which is like in triangle. Okay, well, sure enough, we can do this. This is kind of the whole point of objects. So the way we accomplish this is we declare the original getArea function as a virtual function. So may not be confusing. So you just write the word virtual at the front. And that's saying that this function can be overridden later on. And now, in triangle, we are going to, I just like to put virtual again. Once you put it once, you're set, but I just put it again for my own sanity. So virtual double get area, and I could implement it in the CC file like I've been doing. I'm just going to put the implementation right here in the .h file just because it's easier. How do I want to implement virtual double get area? Right, so 0.5 times base. Oops. Oh, I had started writing the word height before I finished writing the word base. All right, I'm going a little crazy. And remember that I should have had private class variables called int base and height, and presumably these private variables were set in the constructor when this was constructed. So we're making some assumptions here about what I should have done already, but this looks pretty good. So now when getArea is called, we're going to return 0.5 times base times height, which is cool. Now we can make another quick, I'm just going to get rid of this. I'll remember what I was going to talk about. Now I'm going to make another quick class. We'll call this one square, keep it simple. And so this one's also going to be of type shape. So we'll have constructors. What is the square constructor probably going to take as its argument? Right, side length. Inside, and assume we've implemented it, and we have a destructor. And we'd have a private variable for the class called side. And so now we can implement this guy's get area, virtual double get area. I'll just implement it here again, return side times side, like so. And that returns the double. And all is good. You know, when you make a square now, square S with side length 10, then we call S dot get area. It knows that since it's a square, it should call the squares get area function, and this would return, you know, 100. And S dot rotate, well, square rotate probably doesn't do much, but, well, maybe it would if it wasn't, 100 degrees or 360, whatever. Square rotate would see that rotate hadn't been implemented here, and so it would just default to the parent class's rotate. All right, so this is pretty good. But there's kind of still a problem. So the problem is that shape is not really a concrete type. It's like an abstract type, right? Because no one wants to go make a shape and then, you know, no one wants to say shape S and then ask S for its area. I mean, this is like the most unuseful thing ever. That negative one basically means that you made a mistake. You shouldn't have asked for this area because there's no such thing as a shape. So the way we want to implement this is we want to say, look, I'm not actually going to define a function for get area. So I'm not actually going to give you the pleasure of seeing negative 1 when this function is called. I'd rather just say no implementation is provided here. So this is called a pure virtual method. And so what we've done here is we've made a virtual method, and we've said, look, we're not actually going to give you an implementation of this method. So now when someone goes to declare shape S, they're going to get in trouble because the compiler is going to see that S has one or more pure virtual functions. And so C++ will know that it's not something that can be instantiated. There's no way to instantiate it. So I think the kind of the most common question is, like, why the heck would you ever want to do this, right? I mean, why would you want to make an object that is not, doesn't have a, you know, you can't actually make the object. Yeah?
If you didn't define that function there, would you have any difficulty in going and declaring virtual double get area within the triangle, within the square, as you've coded it?
So if you didn't have this pure virtual function? No, you wouldn't have trouble. You could still do get area in each of them. But this is a requirement. So you could still just define them like that without this.
And then if they weren't defined there,
right,
and you tried to call the triangle,
right,
it would be as though the triangle had inherited the virtual double get area equals 0, and then you wouldn't be able to make an instance of a triangle.
Right, exactly. Good. So let me just give that again for video. So if you declare that functions overriding you need, so what this is saying, this pure virtual method is saying, is that functions that implement shapes contract need to provide a get area function. So you could just not put this, but then that's saying something very important. That's saying that shape doesn't need a get area function. In our world, with this example, we always want shape to be able to provide get area. Like, that's the only useful thing we're getting out of shape. So part of the shape contract is that all shapes that inherit should have this get area function. And so furthermore, if triangle forgot to supply get area, then triangle itself would still be pure virtual. So this might make sense in the context of a fancier hierarchy where you have something like an animal, which is obviously abstract because you never want to make an animal, and then you had something like reptile and mammal, and then under reptile, what are some good reptiles? Snake, lizard. What are some good mammals? No, those are all bad. Gorilla was correct. Gorilla is a good mammal. Okay, I'll give you a cat too. So this might still be, so this is clearly pure virtual, right? Because you don't want to be able to declare an animal. And furthermore, you still don't want to be able to make an actual reptile either, right? You only want to make these snake and lizards and these gorillas and cats. So animal might have certain pure virtuals and reptile might override some of the pure virtuals. So if animal had a pure virtual like get type, reptile would override get type to say return reptile or return mammal. But it might not, if animal had a pure virtual called, so let's just make this concrete. So let's say animal had a pure virtual called get type, which is like reptile or mammal, and another pure virtual called get species or whatever. Reptile and mammal are probably going to override get type. They'll provide a concrete implementation for get type, but they won't provide a concrete implementation for get species. You won't get the get species until you get to here. if that makes sense. So you kind of slowly decide like to implement more and more of these pure virtuals. But you're not actually allowed to instantiate an actual object until every single pure virtual has an implementation. Otherwise, that is still an abstract object. Okay, so this idea is called inheritance, where triangle inherits shape's properties and can override some of its functions while still borrowing something like rotate without overriding it. Okay, so let's take a minute to change the tape, and then we will come back and talk about why we're doing all of this. Okay, so the question is, how do you refer to triangle as compared to shape? The shape is called the base class, or sometimes the parent class, and the triangle is the child class. When something inherits from something else, the thing it inherits from is the parent class, and you are now the child class. And then a child class can have its own children, so you get a nice family tree. Okay, so why are we doing all of this? So let's say that we wanted to have, a scene, and the scene is a bunch of shapes. And this is kind of a contrived example, but it's too bad. We have a bunch of shapes, and we are going to define the area of the scene as the area of each of these shapes added up. So you get the area of this, then you add it to get the area of this, and then you add it to get the area of this, and you get the idea. And so that's how you would like to define this scene get area. So so maybe we even have this class called scene, and scene is presumably, we're just going to do a flat array. We'll talk about the STL in a second. So this array has a bunch of shape pointers in it, maybe 128 shape pointers or whatever, and assume that this has already been filled, so the scene constructor will take in an array of shapes already. And so assume that this has already been filled up with the proper array of shapes. So now we want to provide a get area function for this scene. I know this is confusing. It doesn't logically make sense for scene to inherit from, maybe it does actually, for scene to inherit from shape. It probably doesn't make sense in this case, right? Because we don't want to be able to rotate a scene, maybe. So scene, just because it has a get area function, doesn't mean that it necessarily needs to inherit from shape. You only make the inheritance happen if it kind of makes logical sense. But I think a scene is different enough from a shape that we're just going to declare its own scene, and the scene happens to have a get area function, but we don't want scene to be able to do the other shapey things that shapey things can do. So scene itself will not inherit from shape. It'll just be its own class. But we'd like to talk about how to do this get area function. So ideally, I guess we'll need a num shapes too, so we can figure out how to go through the array. So the get area function is going to look like this: double get area, and kind of like what I was drawing. So for I equals 0, while I is less than num shapes, I plus plus, and we are going to, so we're going to keep track of this return value. Start it at 0. So return equals 0 for each of these shapes. We're going to add array of I. Remember, this is a shape pointer, so we're going to call it get area. And then eventually we're going to return ret at the end. So we'd like this to work. We'd like to be able to organize them by shapes, since they all have this shape property. And then we'd like to be able to say, okay, just go through each of these shapes, call the get area, and then return the sum of all of those. And it turns out that this is exactly what will work, and it's because of inheritance. I should write a different keyword. This is called polymorphism. So this combining of several different shapes, so we're actually putting like triangles and squares and circles and various other shapes into this array. That's the array is not full of these shapes. Remember, we can't even make a shape object. So there's no way that this array could be full of shapes. But it's full of pointers to triangles and pointers to circles and pointers to squares. And since those are all shapes, we can just group them as a shape. So it's legal to say shape star S equals new triangle. And remember, triangle took a base and a height, whatever. So shape S equals new triangle. And this is okay because triangle is itself a type of shape. However, it's not okay to do this. Well, it's not okay to do this for several reasons. Even if shape were a concrete object, which it's not because we didn't supply the get area function, this is still not okay. Why is this not okay? So this is okay in a sense because all triangles are shapes, but this is not okay because all shapes are not necessarily triangles. So we can't have a specific pointer holding like a generic pointer. We can only have a generic pointer holding a specific pointer. And that's exactly what we want to do here.
Does that S behave any differently than if you wrote triangle S?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question too. So if we wrote triangle, so how do these two behave differently? They do actually behave differently. So let's say triangle had its own function that you can only do to triangles. Like, come on, give me a clever idea. What can you only do to a triangle that you can't do to generic shapes? Good. Calculate the hypotenuse. So now we're adding to triangle calc hypotenuse. I don't know how to spell that, so it's going to be calc hype. And this function is specific to triangles and is not declared generically in shapes. We will be able to call calc hypotenuse using T arrow calc hypotenuse, but we won't be able to call it using S arrow calc hypotenuse, because the way the compiler treats this is like, okay, well, this is a shape. So I'm going to call calc hypotenuse on the shape, and then it'll be like, wait a minute, shape doesn't have a calc hypotenuse function. Sorry, I can't compute that.
When you call get
area, since shape has a get area, it'll be like, okay, this is an okay function call. And then there's some magic with the virtual keyword that makes it actually go call the right function. And that's a little bit beyond the scope of this. There's a virtual pointer table that enables the base class to actually figure out which is the real function it should call in this case. But that's where the magic lies, is saying S. So you can say S arrow get area, like we did in that example over there. And this will go ahead and do the magic to say, okay, well, first of all, this get area is allowed because shapes like provide a get area function. And not only that, but the get area function will go actually call triangles get area as opposed to square or circles get area. So this is kind of the magic of inheritance and polymorphism right here. Okay, and what it enables us to do at the end of the day is we can group all of the scene as a bunch of shapes. We can just treat them as a bunch of shapes. And now we can just go through this array of shapes, and in the most general way, we can just get the area from each of the shapes and return that. So what would be the alternative if we didn't have this inheritance? How would we have to do this in C?
If we have some kind of
So first of all,
shapes, it would be like if it's triangle, then
Right, but you can't even, you can't, so that's a good point. So you would have to check each guy's type and then call the right thing, but you can't even group them in an array, right?
Yeah.
So that's like the first problem, is that you need to have an array of circles, an array of squares, an array of triangles, or something along those lines to even group them in the first place, or some really nasty casting. It could be done, but it would be bad. And then you need to iterate through each of those individual arrays for each circle, calculate get circle, add those to the return values, now for each square, and it just gets a lot uglier. So this generic thing is very, very powerful. Maybe not in this example, but kind of as you move on. And similarly, you might ask, like, why we would bother. So if we have this generic animal base class and these four types of animals, why we would bother making this reptile subclass? This is because it provides a join point, in the sense that you can now, if you had wanted to, you could now make an array of reptiles and call reptile functions on them that maybe mammals don't have. So this specificity is almost, or is sometimes very important if you wanted to be able to make an array of reptiles, that if you have a set of reptile-only functions that you want to be able to call on a bunch of these individual reptiles, then that's why you would have a reptile subclass. But it wouldn't be worthwhile if all of these just have animal object, like animal, generic animal things. Then you could just always just group them as animals, and you wouldn't need this distinction. But anyway, that's kind of a subtle point. Don't worry about it too much. Okay, so this is polymorphism. Inheritance is this idea that you can override a virtual class, and you also inherit your parents' functions if you don't want to rewrite all of the functions. And inheritance and polymorphism is kind of the basic idea of object-oriented programming, and also this protection of data with private members and blah, blah, blah. Okay, cool. So let's move on to the STL. This is kind of, as I mentioned at the beginning, this is why I use C++. You know, most of the time, unless you're making a really large program, you don't actually need, you don't need all of this fanciness with classes and inheriting stuff. But the STL is just kind of an incredibly nice, convenient thing. So I will talk about it briefly. So first of all, let me just talk about, STL stands for the Standard Template Library. And kind of the key word I want to talk about is template. So I always screw up the syntax. So you can make your own templated data types in C++. Let me just, I don't do this a whole lot, but it's important to realize. So let's say you wanted to make a generic linked list node. Why would you want a linked list node to be generic? What about a linked list node? So you're going to go through all this trouble to, you know, define all of these linked list library functions. What about this linked list node do you want to be generic? So before, we kind of always just put ints in here, right? But you might want to be able to just put, like, whatever object you want in here and just, you know, have all the linked list functions operate on and work with whatever type is in here, right? So you'd like to be able to define at the same time a linked list for integers, then simultaneously be defining a linked list for strings, and at the same time be defining a linked list for any type of object you might want to store. So the way to accomplish this in C++ is a template. And let me just show you quickly. This is kind of beyond the scope, I think, of probably anything you do, but let me just show it to you quickly. So you'd say template. It's pretty simple. Just the syntax is always confusing. So you'd say template. So you're saying this is saying that this is a templated class, and X is the variable. So X is the type of whatever this data is that we're storing in here. That's called X. All right, so class linked list node. And here, so what types of functions do we want from a linked list node? Probably. Well, let's just assume that there's a get value. Okay. And then a set value. And then there's some private data, like, you know, maybe the next pointer, and then whatever the value, the current value is. So does this make sense, what I'm doing? So instead of, so if you replaced x with ints, then generic, then we would have this. So if we made a templated class with ints and we literally went through and replaced all of these underlined x's with ints, then we would get this. If we went through and we changed all x's to strings, then we would get this. And you kind of see how this works? Get val always returns whatever the type of the value is, whether it's int, string, bool, whatever. And val itself is always of the type string, int, bool, whatever. And so this idea is the idea of a template. And the way it actually works is kind of nasty. The way it's actually implemented is it makes the code, the actual code file, bigger. So if you use a template, if you use a linked list node that's of type int, the way you declare that is ll node bracket int, like this. It will go replace all of this templated code with ints. So it will make an int here, an int here, an int here. And then let's say later on in the code, we're like, oh, well, it would be useful to have a linked list full of strings. So we make a linked list node string here, node 2 or whatever. And now it will replace all of the, it will make a new copy of this in the code, and it will replace all of it with strings. And it will do that for each type that you want to make in your linked list. So the idea, what?
Not each instance.
Not each instance. Each type. Right, right. Oh, that would be horrendous. But it does, if you're using heavy templating, it does make your code size bigger. And this is the reason. The executable size.
How many data types do you come up with?
Oh, you can do a lot of stuff. You can actually do a lot of computation with templating. It's like called template metaprogramming. You can do crazy stuff with templates. But this is good for now. And the only reason I'm really introducing this is so that we can understand really what the standard templates library is doing. So, you know, kind of inspired by this linked list idea, they're like, okay, well, we're going to make this vector, which is an array, a fancy array. And we don't want to write a vector for ints and a vector for bools and a vector for strings and a vector for holding all things. So we'll just make a templated thing. So if we want a vector of ints, we say vector int v or whatever. And by the way, if you do this, you would have to write standard colon colon. So at the top of your file, you'd say using namespace standard, like std. So now we can just write vector int v. And this gets us a kind of in our minds, it gets us a vector, an empty vector, like an empty array, which we can start writing to. So let's say we want to put something into the array. Well, here we just say v push back, and now push back means push something onto the end of the array. And now what type are we expected to put in here, given the type that we've declared? Int, good. So we push back a 5 maybe. And so now in our minds this array holds a 5. You know, maybe we push back some more values, 10, whatever. In our minds this holds 5, 10. I mean, it's not actually doing that per se. But anyway, and now we could say something like vector.size, and it would return what? Two, good, which is like the length of the vector. So this is nice, because remember whenever we were passing around arrays in the olden days, we needed to pass along a separate variable, which is the length of the array. And so now vector kind of just holds all of this good information for us, right? It holds the size, it holds the actual objects. If we want to put some new stuff into the vector, it makes the vector bigger automatically for us. So just doing all of this stuff for us. And sure enough, there's a list type, which is implements a linked list. There is a priority queue, which efficiently implements, a heap. It's called priority queue, though. There is a, I think there's a stack one, which implements a stack. I think there's one called queue, which implements a plain queue. So all these data structures, which you would have to, you know, spend like 30 minutes or an hour writing yourself, you can just get them for free just using this. So that's kind of all I really wanted to say about the STL. It is incredibly useful, and you don't really ever use flat arrays anymore in C, because there's, or in C++, you would use a vector instead, because a vector is just a far nicer thing to play with. So that's a good question. Does the implementation slow things down? Kind of, but I mean, so if you're very specific about what you would want to resize things to, like if you have, you know that if you, you know that the proper way to resize given your application is always double, because if you get, so you start at 10 objects, and you know that in your application, if you get an 11th object, then that means you're getting at least 20 objects. So the proper resizing would be to go from 10 to 20. Then if you get a 21st object, you know that with very high probability, maybe you're getting 40 objects. So if you know something about this, the way you should resize, then it might be a good idea to make your own like homebrewed vector. But they have very, I mean, first of all, reallocating for bigger space is not the end of the world. Occasionally it's inefficient. But they have very good algorithms for knowing. No. So, that's a great question. So it seems like we reallocate every single time. What's actually happening under the hood, though, is they have, you know, some pre-allocated buffer, right? Maybe it's 10 long. That's what's sitting underneath the hood is an actual array, and they're keeping track of, you know, where the last element is in the array, so that if you push back, you get it on the real one. Oh no, I guess they have that already from the length of the array. But they keep track of basically, so the kinds of things they're keeping track of is size of the array, which is how many things, size of the, which is how many things are actually in the vector, and then they would also have a size of buffer, which is how much memory they had actually already allocated for this buffer. And you can tell a vector to start off with enough space for 100 things if you wanted to. You can tell it how to size its buffer from the very start. So it's keeping track of all this underneath the scenes. And then if it sees that size of vector, when you're adding something, gets bigger than the size of the buffer, then it knows it needs to go reallocate the buffer, copy the stuff over, resize size of buffer, and then return to you. And it does all of that underneath the scene so that you never have to think about it. But it's doing reasonably efficient things. Yeah?
So if you want to like, run through all the elements of a vector, would you use the size in like a for loop, or is there fancier?
So there is fancier stuff. So if you want to go through an iterator, a vector, there is a, so you could just go the old way. For I equals 0, while I is less than v dot size, I plus plus, and then you just like, I don't know, printf, well, you can use C out in C++, but let's do printf v of I, and that will do the right thing. There's also something called an iterator, and if you're using fancier types, you might need to declare an iterator, and we can talk offline about how you declare an iterator. There's this generic iterator class, basically, which is what you're supposed to use for traversing all of these STL containers. But with a vector, I mean, obviously it's doing v of I in constant time because it's just doing random access on the array. So that's a perfectly okay way of doing it. Although that may change if you take CS51, you'll have to use iterators. But anyway, iterators are very nice too, because if you were to change, you know, your implementation, you're like, oh, I want to use a linked list instead of a vector, you just literally change the word vector to list twice, and the iterator for a linked list works exactly how an iterator for a vector works, so you don't have to change any of your other code, so it's kind of cool. Yeah, so you can put a class in here, so we could put student if we wanted, or whatever class we wanted, as long as it's already defined as a type. Yeah, anything you want in there, and it will store it. Right, so well then vector v of I would return a student. Yeah. So then you do dot GPA or dot age or dot whatever. Cool. Okay, so kind of the last thing I wanted to do, and we're running low on time, is just kind of think about a problem in terms of an object-oriented way. So the problem we're going to think about is designing a tic-tac-toe-like game. And we want classes, and I would like you to participate in this since I don't have the solution in my head already. What kinds of classes do you think this tic-tac-toe game should have? So it has a graphics library, has some artificial intelligence maybe. We want classes for this game. So what seem like good classes? Okay, good, a player class. And this might be an abstract class, right? Because you wouldn't make an actual player, you would make only humans and computers. So if you wanted computers. So the player is going to define things like get move, but it's not actually going to implement them. So get move, what would get move for a human do? It would get from the graphics library a click or something. But for a computer, what would it do? Right, it would. So if you had a very simple one, it would randomly pick a spot, or it would go do some fancy algorithm to compute the best optimal move, and that's what the get move would do. So right, so we want this generic player, and then obviously we'll want, you know, the player should have a name, and get name will probably be implemented in player itself, since get name will do the same thing for both human and computer. Good, so we have this player. What else do we want? So what's kind of the most concrete? Yeah, good. So we want a board. So underneath the board will actually be stored the vector or 2D array. You can make a 2D vector. 2D vector or 2D array. That's what sits underneath the board. What else sits underneath the board? So that's what the board actually is. Would it have anything else? I can't. So right, so it would probably have dimensions, good. So width and height. And you'd want to be able to ask the board, is spot taken maybe? And pass in an int I and an int j, or like row and a column. And this should return a bool. So you want to think about what types of things your board should be able to tell you to the outside world. Good. So, and then we might want a game. And game might hold the actual board object in it. And game might have things like, I don't know, maybe not for this, because everything's a legal move, but for some games, is legal move. You know, the game is maybe the class responsible for all the game logic.
Mm-hmm. Go to board to see.
Right. Okay. So that's a great question. So why do we want is legal move in game and not in board? So you could implement it in board, but this is kind of one of those big design decisions. So for me, I want to think of the board as just kind of a dirt simple representation of like the data structure, and I want to think of game as the object that knows about the rules of this specific game. So my game will hold a board. So for chess, it might hold a chess board. For tic-tac-toe, it'll hold a tic-tac-toe board. For Connect Four, it'll hold a Connect Four board. And my game, if I want to change the rules, my game will be the implementation that I change. It knows everything about the rules. But it's kind of a big design decision you have to make, is defining concretely what you want each of these classes to be about, if that makes sense. But yeah, there's no right answer. I think, like, just given experience, I think you would see that probably putting it in game is more reasonable. Putting all of the game logic in game is more reasonable, and then just having board implement like a dirt simple, like, I'm a board, I have pieces here, you can change me, might be a more logical way to do it. But if you disagree, that's okay. You could.
I was just trying to think, like, behind the scenes, like, what would happen if we check the board?
Okay, yeah, so is legal move. So remember, boards is a private variable of game, basically. So you can always. So you'll just access the board, like, tell me this spot. Or, like, I don't know, if your legality of the move depends on, I don't know what it would depend on, but you might need to check what else is on the board. Like in chess, if you move a bishop diagonally, the first thing you check is, okay, is the coordinates actually along a diagonal? And then you would have to check each spot on the board in between to make sure that there's no pawn blocking the diagonal or whatever. So then you would use your board object here to check against each thing. And then finally, if it is a legal move, you would return true, and then maybe game would be responsible for making the move also. Or maybe you just have is legal move, make the move at the end. You'd have to define it how you want to. Okay, and then there's kind of, for the graphics you'd want, I always have trouble naming these. Maybe you want to run game class, or maybe you would want to call it graphics class. And this is kind of, the class involves, this is the class that actually has control of the whole game. So main is just going to be making one of these graphics classes and saying run. And then this will control the main loop that interacts with each player object and asks players to move, and then interacts with the game object to make sure the move is legal or goes back to the player object. And then these will use the board object, but maybe run game doesn't have direct access to the board object. It only has access to the game, which is how you interact with the board object. So you need to kind of design all of this and make sure that, first of all, it makes logical sense that each object kind of has a logical grouping of data and describes something, if not concrete, at least something that makes sense in your head. So maybe the notion of a game, you couldn't, like, well, I don't know, there almost is a concrete representation. It's like the list of rules and the board and kind of all the stuff you'd find in a game box. But maybe sometimes you won't actually be able to come up with something that quite that concrete for what you're representing, but at least it should be a concrete idea. Like this is like a coherent idea that's like tightly knit. I don't know, it's kind of hard to explain. So you don't always need to have a physical object that it models, but at least an object in some sense of the word. All right, so if I were designing this is probably roughly the class structure I'd want to do. And this is kind of the type of thing that we'd like you to do by, what is it, do Monday? I forget, the design and framework
document.
Yeah, I mean, I would have a class hierarchy and explain how various things interact with other things. And I think the thing that was really useful to students last year, and I wish we had required you to do it, but we didn't, is we required students make a milestone. And what that means is just get something up. So get up your game board, or like get up, like your, if you're setting up an IDE, make sure it compiles something slightly non-trivial. And it can be very simple, like people making a card game, all they did was they got a window up and they got, like, you know, the ace of spades, ace of hearts, I don't know how to make a spade, on the game board, and that was it. Like, once they could just print a card on the board, then they kind of, like, were at a spot that they could go do some work at over break. And, you know, some of them wanted to do work, and if you're at this spot, then there's kind of places to launch from here. But people who didn't make this milestone just, I don't know, they tend not to really feel like they can start at over break. So I know the feeling, they just push it off until January 4th, and then reading period gets very ugly because you have this, you know, 30, 40-hour project that needs to get done. So I would push yourself not only to design this framework, but also to try to get some simple example up, even if it's really pretty trivial and just takes you a couple hours. Just get the libraries working and compiling while there's a TF there to help you, because that's kind of the most frustrating part. And once you get this up and you have a general idea of where to go, then maybe there's a chance you'll do it over break. I mean, some people really find it fun, so Other people don't, but that's okay. So that's what I would recommend, although I think, I haven't really read the document that closely, but I think the way we phrase it is we just really want more of this design and framework rather than the actual example of something running. Don't quote me on that, though. Read it carefully. All right, cool. Any last questions? All right, so if you like this stuff, take CS51. This is kind of all, CS51 is all about designing stuff and coming up with abstractions and learning C++ and kind of these features of C++ in much more detail. And then you can go get jobs. All right, cool, thanks. Yes, I know people have gotten jobs with CS50 and 51.